Welcome back to RN Breakfast on this Christmas morning. David Rutledge with you through till 9 o'clock. And for this hour, we're taking a look back over the past 12 months to bring you some of the top stories from the RN Religion and Ethics team. Earlier this year, RN's Encounter series ran a three-part special looking at faith and reason. It's become something of a vexed issue in recent years. You could say that religious faith and scientific reason have been at odds with each other ever since the European Enlightenment. But today we're seeing the popularisation of a sort of crusading atheism that says religion essentially asks you to leave your brain at the door when you sign up, and this makes it not only silly, but positively dangerous. Well, as part of this Encounter series on faith and reason, I spoke with English writer Francis Spufford. His most recent book is entitled Unapologetic: Why, Despite Everything, Christianity Can Still Make Surprising Emotional Sense. And it's an attempt to give some account of what the Christian experience feels like from within, but not in any sort of in-house devotional sense. His intended readership is made up of those atheists who think Christians are some sort of strange alien species. Here's Francis Spufford.
There used to be a kind of détente between belief and non-belief, a kind of a state in which mutual respect was possible, resting on a kind of foundation of acknowledged ignorance. They didn't know and admitted it. We didn't know. We admitted it. They would go, I can see a certain nobility in your wild gamble on the universe having some meaning, yada, yada. And people could nod to each other, sometimes a bit, you know, a bit frostily, arguments about the Spanish Inquisition and so on. But there was a basis for getting along there. Whereas what has happened has been an attempt to say, actually, no, there isn't an even balance of probabilities to our ignorance here. So, in fact, our sense that there's no God is much, much, much more probable than your sense that there might be a God. So the burden of proof is all on you, and we need show no respect whatever for your wild leap of faith, because we now consider it to be a wild leap of self-evident nonsense. And this has some interesting rhetorical effects. I think it's got a lot to do with how much more bad-tempered the argument has got over the last few years. I also think it's groundless, because once you look at the reasons why religion is self-evidently nonsense as far as they're concerned, why they think it's a wild and outlying possibility, which it's up to religious people to prove the merit of, and what you see is a set of cultural judgments, things filtered through our public imagination into apparent common sense, things which have got much more to do with how people live and the tendency of people to play five-a-side football on Sunday morning rather than go to church and things, rather than any actual philosophical advance. I don't think it's got traction, what they're saying.
What about when Christianity asks scientific questions about itself, though? If we look at the attempts by Christian theologians down the ages to frame Christianity in terms that make scientific sense, you know, Thomas Aquinas and his five proofs of the existence of God, this kind of thing. Does this get us somewhere in the end, this sort of rational inquiry into religion, or is it a misunderstanding of faith in some way?
Well, reason means several different things, doesn't it? There is the reasonableness of faith within itself. There's the way that a religion like Christianity makes sense in terms of its own tradition. You can ask whether something is consistent with Christianity, a perfectly simple kind of logical operation, and say yes or no. The question is whether reason of that kind gives you a grip on what is the case out there in the universe. And with all due reverence for Thomas Aquinas, who was a great man and a great mind, I don't think so. However, before we go, ooh, generations of deluded Christians, we need to go, hang on a minute, there's the actual history of the world to take account of here. And what someone like Aquinas thought he was doing was very much governed by the moment he was doing it in. It is a recent development over the last 200 or 300 years. By some standards, that is recent, considering how much human history there is. It's a recent development to say that science is a different thing, that reason is a different thing from religion. What's happened is that when Aquinas was going, there was one blob called thought, which attempted to encompass everything that we now think of as religion and everything that we now think of as science and philosophy. That's why the medieval church brought in Aristotle to try and do its physics and its biology for it. Why did the church need to do physics and biology? Because they thought that truth was one. I think since the Enlightenment, which, you know, modern Christians are children of, just like modern atheists, we can see and we need to see that reason and faith do different things, not competing things, but different things. And our sense of there all being one undifferentiated blob of question to be asked has gone away, and rightly gone away. There is now and again such a thing as progress, and that's an example.
We do have a sort of a split, though, today, don't we, between faith and empiricism, if you like. And I want to talk a little about the incarnation here and this idea that Jesus inhabited a historical place and time. He did extraordinary things for which the Gospels claim to offer documentary evidence, and the yep. Christian is required to accept that evidence, just like the scientist is required to accept scientific evidence. I just wonder if there's an implicit appeal to reason there, right at the heart of Christian faith, in that the believer believes in certain things for which the Gospels are held to provide evidence. And I wonder if Christianity is maybe doomed to having to defend itself, therefore, in empirical terms.
There are different issues going on there together. One is that, yes, Christianity absolutely is making an empirical and historical claim. It's one of the strengths and, of course, the weaknesses of the religion, that it doesn't just say in some abstract philosophical way there is a God. It says, and he walked, talked, ate, drank, died, rose again at a particular historical address in Palestine round about AD 30. So in principle, yes, Christianity is actually open to historical disproof, the way that a pure deism that just believed in an abstract God wouldn't be. For me, that's immensely valuable because it means that Christianity brings all of the God talk down into the nitty-gritty of human experience. But it cannot be denied that there is a weakness in that as well. In theory, some document could turn up in a cistern in the outskirts of Jerusalem and we'd all be going, oh. Or a set of astonishingly well-preserved bones with a really unambiguous clay tablet at their feet. But that's really not very likely. So what we have to do with that, I think, is just to go, yes, we are trailing out there in the world. We are, from that point of view, open to disproof. That is an area of genuine overlap where Christianity makes an evidential claim. And if somebody comes up with some other better evidence, then we're stuffed and would need to throw our hands up and go, oh dear, we misunderstood something. It was kind of a mythology based on an early first century cult that all went a bit terribly wrong. However, that hasn't actually happened, and we also need to guard against overdoing the implications of that. Yes, Christians read the Gospels and feel a sense of direct, substantiated connection with the life of Christ. I don't think that means taking it as evidence the same way you take Galileo's evidence for how gravity works. I think that is taking it as evidence in the broader sense in which you believe in the things that happen in your own life. You have evidence that your wife, husband, partner, lover, boyfriend, girlfriend loves you. You couldn't summarize it on the back of an envelope. Nevertheless, it's made up of things that have happened, things that are really there, the nitty-gritty of experience. And for a Christian reading the Gospels, they provide, at a long, you know, at the far end of the historical telescope, nevertheless, days and hours and minutes in which we think we can hear kind of God talking and breaking bread. That's extremely important. And paying the price of vulnerability to some theoretical disproof, if it ever comes along, that's a price worth paying for feeling that we have that intimate access to something concrete and tangible.
But there are some things, aren't there, that will never be proven or disproven, and yet they're quote-unquote outlandish things, maybe unreasonable things to which one gives assent. I mean, the historical actuality of the miracles that Jesus performed, for example, is that something that you believe in yourself?
Yes. Yes, I do, because it seems to me that if I've bought the whole suggestion that God was human for a while, then if I could swallow that, there's really not very much problem with imagining that if the creator of the universe was temporarily inside it and had hands and feet, then things might behave a little differently for him than it does for the rest of us, that there might be a kind of thinning of the fabric and very, very small temporary suspensions of all the natural laws that we know about. On the other hand, that's a kind of cold way of putting it. What I would rather say is that I give emotional assent to the resurrection and to the healing miracles. The healing miracles clearly don't actually get Jesus very far. Otherwise, he wouldn't be doing crucifixion and resurrection and the redemption of the world by some other means. But they seemed to me to they are sitting there at the point of human yearning. They are a story, by which I do not mean an untruth, in which what we long for, that the blind should see and that the lame should walk, just happens that once, just then. And I don't think that it's a cruel fairy tale to give assent to that. I think it is a measure of the depth of our longing that the world should be mended, that we believe that just once for those particular people it happened.
So they make emotional sense as much as anything else.
They do. And emotional sense is not a trivial thing. I stuck emotional sense in the subtitle of my book, Unapologetic, because it seemed to me to be really central, not just to the claims that religion makes, but to the way we navigate our way through ordinary lives. Without getting into the whole thing about whether there's such a thing as emotional intelligence, it seems to me that human wisdom and human capacity for love is an amazingly unabstract thing. It has to do with our semi-conscious apprehension of everyone we meet and the stories we manage to tell ourselves of our lives. And that to say none of that matters, what matters is whether you can, you know, where's your evidence? That seems to me to be a gross reduction of the everyday richness of experience. When I say it makes emotional sense, I mean that it answers to our kind of deepest and most scrupulous judgments about what love is and who we are. I don't just mean it would be lovely and comfy to believe it, and I want to believe that lovely and comfy things are necessarily true. Ooh, let me hug the universe like a great big cuddly blanket. No, I mean that actually it's as uncomfortable, it's as deeply open to our desiring and our wondering and our doubting and our anguish as we would need things to be if we were really taking them seriously.
You're with RN Breakfast on this Christmas morning. I'm David Rutledge and I'm speaking with English writer Frances Spufford. So if you take a question like, does God exist, which is what a lot of the Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and their fellow travellers, they seem to be very hung up on this question. And yet when I read Unapologetic, I get the sense that for you it's not an important question at all, or the faith lies elsewhere.
It's not an answerable question. I do, as a matter of fact, believe that God exists. He certainly seems to, in my experience. But I can't know it, and the idea of banging endlessly on about his existence seems to me to ask the most boring possible question about God, as well as asking a question we can't settle. And the idea that, I've got a friend who calls them the evidence Daleks, because they're constantly going, where is your evidence? And I would rather talk about things beyond the range of evidence, Daleks. Not that it doesn't matter whether God exists. I'm not saying religion is a delightful spare time activity which can be conducted in the absence of truth. I'm saying that the envelope that contains the news about whether God is real or not is sealed and is going to remain sealed, and that it is therefore sensible to ask other questions. As we can't open the bloody envelope, we might as well ask what happens when we believe, what the tradition of belief has meant, how belief fits together with the lives we have now, how we put belief together with the respect for science that we all ought to have, especially Christians. If you follow a God of truth, you're supposed to not be frightened of the truth wherever it goes. Also, there's something culturally misleading about where the arguments got stuck about whether God exists. We've had religion reduced to this sort of Punch and Judy show, kind of, oh, no, he doesn't. Oh, yes, he does. Oh, no, he doesn't. Bang, 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 bang. And it produces very little light. And it actually persuades non-religious people, both the kind of the hardcore hobbyists of unbelief who have this powerful negative emotional relationship with belief and what they're anti-religious, both them and the huge middle ground of people who just aren't bothered, it leaves them under a misapprehension about what believers are. It makes people think that believers are people who get up in the morning and go, does God exist? As a religious person, I care strongly about this. I'm going to spend the rest of the day thinking, does God exist? Is he there? And it's not the case. Since we don't know but have decided to take the leap of faith, what we actually spend our days doing is, you know, living, feeling, hoping, loving, trusting, all of that stuff. And that, it seems to me, is now more mysterious to the world outside Christian belief than it ever has been before. People think that we must be engaged in this strange, slightly alien set of activities which don't touch on the ordinary conduct of lives, whereas they are absolutely a response to the same material of human life that everybody else is feeling. So what I wanted the book to do was to produce some recognition, not to make an argument for God's existence, heaven help us, not to do anything so boring, but to do what books do, which is to give you imaginative sympathy for lives and positions which are not your own. I know it's been read by Christians with a kind of satisfied, aha, that's what we believe, but its real audience is non-believers who are interested in how on earth it can work, because I'd like them to feel briefly what the view from over here is like. And, you know, the view is not a philosophical view. The view is an experienced view. It's to do with the emotional weight you give things.
Well, it's interesting that you say that the view is not a philosophical view, because that makes me think of Paul's verse in 1 Corinthians, where he says, "We preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Greeks, foolishness to the Gentiles." There's been a lot written on exactly what Paul meant by that phrase, but to me it suggests that there's something about Christianity that will always be at odds with philosophy and reason and good sense. And I wonder if there are aspects of your faith that are in conflict with your rational sense and that require you to sort of place reason to one side, you know, things that you take on faith, even though intellectually you might feel uncomfortable about them.
For me, the foolishness that Paul is talking about there is to do with the way that Christianity points you emphatically away from prudence and self-protective common sense of various kinds. When Paul's operating, philosophy is partly to do with cognition and truth and knowledge and things, but it's also a discipline and a doctrine of how to live. There is a Greek tradition there which says what a good citizen is. There you are, you're a political animal, like Aristotle says. You go to the gymnasium, you fulfill your duties in the sunshine, you're a man, obviously. You know, you look after yourself, you try to be virtuous, you die, everybody is glad, there's poetry. A ridiculous summary of Greek philosophy, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, but there we go. And Christianity is asking for something much more paradoxical than that. It's saying, stuff the virtues, or rather, the virtues are only byproducts of much, much more important things, that you should make a prat of yourself in the world's eyes. You should trip over your feet if necessary. You should show goodwill to strangers and enemies, that you should love freely and wildly with abandon in silly directions. So there's that. There are also ways in which it asks for acts of trust, for wild jumps, which are foolish if you buy the idea that we're only ever supposed to put our feet on solid ground in this life, that we're only supposed to go with what we can prove. But that sounds like a life without imagination, as far as I'm concerned. And everybody uses their imagination. Everybody is walking on fantastical or enchanted ground some of the time. It's just that we don't all acknowledge it. And when Christianity says, be foolish, sometimes it just seems to me to be saying, kind of, there's nothing under your feet. Because there's nothing under anybody's feet at these moments. Just be aware that you're not standing on anything here. You're leaning on the empty air and trusting it to take your weight. Whether there are actual tangible collisions between my commitments to reason and my commitments to faith, well, I hope not, but there probably are, aren't there? They don't come up, though, in that kind of self-consciously organised form of reason that we call science. I don't think I compromise where respect for science is concerned at all, but I do think that faced with situations that don't seem to offer a footing for hope or good outcomes, I will attempt to believe that there's more there than meets the eye. I will go against evidence where the evidence is only dark. Again, I don't think that's unreasonable in the other sense, but I am standing on the thin air. I do acknowledge that.
This makes me think of a passage in Unapologetic where you say that you write that belief demands that you dispense with illusion after illusion, while contemporary common sense requires continual fluffy pretending. It sort of turns the familiar atheist formula on its head. What do you mean when you say that?
I mean that a lot of contemporary atheism has swallowed some Enlightenment nonsense about humanity's intrinsic goodness, that a lot of the time, particularly kind of angry atheists seem to be working to a model in which we are naturally virtuous and happy creatures who have been hideously deformed by the pressures of religion. If you just took religion away, we'd kind of spring upwards to our natural forms and all would be well, which you can see in popular form in something like John Lennon's Imagine, which I'm very rude about in the book. I'm going to be rude about again on the radio. I call it the My Little Pony of philosophical statements, and it's complete crap. That can be really offensive. It's a heroin addict's pretense that everything is warm and soupy. That's what it is. And to base your idea of human nature on the idea that only external powers, like nasty old religion, which is obviously done by something other than people, only that presses us out of shape, seems to me to be not only an illusion, but a very high maintenance illusion. You have to stick your fingers in your ears and ignore huge amounts of human experience to keep that up. And it produces these kind of cycles in public life in which most of the time there's this kind of indulgent, yay us stuff going on, followed by horrible stagey surprises as something vile happens with the serial killer or with child abuse. And if we could manage to be a little more realistic about ourselves in the first place, if we could bring to bear some of the friendly pessimism, which I think Christianity is rather good at, then we wouldn't be constantly wrong-footed by this news, which shouldn't be news anymore, ladies and gentlemen, about what we're actually capable of. Christianity stops you from being surprised about the shit people do. The shit is built in to Christianity's estimate of what people are. We don't think that they are cuddly and fluffy. We think that they're lovable with eyes absolutely open. And what we presume, hope for, possibly imagine, is a God who sees us absolutely plain, plainer than we can possibly see ourselves, and finds us of value anyway.
Francis Spufford, author of the book Unapologetic, Why, Despite Everything, Christianity Can Still Make Surprising Emotional Sense. The interview was taken from a program that went to air on RN's Encounter series earlier this year. And to hear more, check the website at abc.net.au/RN. Choose RN Breakfast from the program menu.